Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. TNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks. Like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit Dick's.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hey there, horror lovers from all across the U.S. of A. and beyond. This is Eric Peabody, your host of the Horror Hill podcast. First off, let me give you a big thank you from the bottom of our cold, haunted hearts for sticking with us through thick and thin over the last decade. You've been the lifeblood of Chilling Entertainment, helping us conjure up the spine-tingling stories and nightmarish content you crave. But now, we're standing at a bit of a crossroads, and we need a hand from our beloved community. Our fearless leader, Craig Groshek, has been navigating some seriously rough waters these past few years. Financial burdens, including mounting costs and declining advertising revenue across the industry, have made it difficult to keep the gears turning without a little extra help from our friends. Craig's been giving it his all, fighting to keep both the Chilling Entertainment family, our incredible writers, voice actors, sound designers, and all the ghouls behind the scenes, safe and sound. But folks, the reality is we're running low on resources, and we need your help to keep the darkness alive. We're kicking off a GoFundMe campaign with a goal of raising $10,000. It's what we need right now to keep the ship afloat. This money will go directly to our most pressing needs, like paying off debts and making sure our talented team gets the fair wages they deserve. Listeners, without your support, we're facing a real horror story. Cutting pay, losing key players, and, heaven forbid, seeing some of our favorite shows take a dirt nap, maybe for good. But with your help, we can flip the script and keep Chilling Entertainment not just alive, but thriving like a vampire at a blood bank. You can help us out right now by heading to www.helpchilling.org, that's HELPCHILLING.ORG, to donate today. There are other ways to help too, such as spreading the word like wildfire on social media. Tell every horror fiend you know about our campaign and help us bring more eyes and ears to Chilling Tales for Dark Nights and our other bone-chilling programs. But right now, the best thing you can do is chip in, whatever you can. Every single dollar helps, and every share spreads the fear. I mean, the word. Let's keep Chilling Entertainment turning out the darkness for years to come. So please, donate today. We've got a lot more scares to share, and we'd hate to miss out on bringing you the thrills you crave. Again, you can head to www.helpchilling.org today to help out. Thank you again for your support.
The following program is a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights, and a proud member of the Simply Scary Podcast Network. Visit simplyscarypodcast.com to learn more about this and our other weekly storytelling programs, and become a patron today to show your support and get instant access to our extensive archive of downloadable ad-free tales of terror. Thank you for listening, and enjoy the show.
Disclaimer: Horror Hill is a horror anthology podcast bringing you scary stories from all corners of the internet and beyond. As such, certain stories include content that some listeners might find offensive. Specifically, tonight's episode includes a mention of suicide. Listener discretion is advised. Good evening, listeners, and welcome back to Horror Hill. I'm your host, Eric Peabody, and tonight's episode features two stories for you, a nice little treat to chill your bones as we shake off the last bits of summer. Our opening tale is The Fortune Teller by Sam Morris. Our narrator is a young boy experiencing one of his first tastes of freedom. He's walking by himself to go meet a friend before they head to church. This friend, Thomas, lives in a large Gothic mansion with his reclusive mother. Though they're well-to-do, tragedy struck Thomas's family recently, taking his father from him in a rather concerning fashion. Now, as the two boys walk to church, they're unaware that they're about to meet someone with some bizarre and frightening information, as well as a terrible offer for Thomas. Following that, we'll close out our evening with The Arm Thief by A.W. Mason. You know, folks, I've often thought that police procedurals are just one small nudge away from being outright horror stories, and this one seems to prove that point. After all, how can it not be horror when it opens with a string of severed arms? Detectives Robertson and Gannon are out in the hot Florida sun cleaning up the most recent killing, which seems to be related to some newly developed technology. As they follow the scant clues at their disposal, they head deeper into the mind of a ravenous madman. You're listening to the standard edition of this program. If you'd like to help support Horror Hill and also remove these pesky ads, head to chillingtalesfordarknights.com and click Patrons in the upper menu to sign up today. You'll get instant access to hundreds of ad-free stories, and we can scale back some of our less savory means of generating money for the show. By the way, you wouldn't happen to still have all of your organs, would you? And now, from author Sam Morris, I present The Fortune Teller. It was a cold spring morning, the type of weather that can confuse the soul. I thought we were past all this. Everything in the world looks so kind, so friendly. Why does it feel so cruel? Outside the window, the fresh color and sunshine say, "Come play." But when you run out and greet the day with an outstretched hand, it slaps you and says, "Stay away, you aren't welcome here, unless you want to get hurt." These thoughts filled my 12-year-old mind as I skipped out the front door and into the morning. Luckily, I was already wearing a suit jacket my mother had laid out for me, so the bitter cold didn't cut quite as sharp. I still shoved my hands into the pockets of my slacks and pressed my chin against my tie as I made my way to the road, turning around and waving to my parents, who stood on the wooden porch of our modest one-story farmhouse. "Be careful! We'll see you there! On time this time, please!" my mother playfully hollered. Her Sunday best didn't offer the insulation of a two-piece suit, so she wrapped her arms around the midsection of my father, who smiled and waved. "See y'all there," I weakly responded, still reeling from the chill. I was thankful that they finally let me do a few things on my own, even if it's just meeting up with my friend Thomas and walking with him to church every week. I walked out of our gravel driveway and started down the road. We lived on the top of a hill that sloped about a half mile into a quaint little downtown, where our church steeple reached proudly up into the cold blue sky. I could see it clearly, even though I was only a few steps from my family's mailbox. The ivory spire was stark against the new life green and smiling pinks and purples in the trees around it. I could see my sigh as I took it all in. I shuffled my black loafers carefully over the road, not concerned with passing cars, for there were always so few, but as to avoid the dirty creases in the asphalt and the icy mud-filled potholes that littered the way. It had been a harsh winter, with several potent snowstorms that always tore my poor little town's infrastructure to hell. As per tradition, repairs wouldn't be complete until late summer. I could still see fallen trees on most of my neighbor's properties, cleanly sawed into what always reminded me of a sleeve of Ritz crackers. About halfway between my house and the church was Thomas's house. He lived right on the elbow of the only bend in the road, down right as the way started getting steeper. As I approached his driveway, my pace slowed, even as my feet moved quicker to keep me upright. And suddenly, I was off the road and facing the large wrought iron gate that stood guard for the Sanderson's mansion. Twisting back up the hill from the gate was a cobblestone driveway that led to a large, three-story, Gothic-style manor. I'd never been inside, even though for the past year I had visited weekly. That suited me fine. Thomas's house always felt dark and mean and sharp to the touch. Perhaps it was the color of it. Perhaps it was how ominously it stood on the hill, overlooking our humble, if not impoverished, town. Or perhaps it was the tragedy that always came to mind when I stopped by. Thomas's father had passed away just over a year prior. Dr. Sanderson had been a prominent pillar in the community, always respected, even seemingly worshipped at times. He was an elder at the church and the leader of several civil clubs. In the end, he was found in the back seat of his black Bentley Continental, pants around his Luchess boots with four bullet holes in him. His personal secretary and her husband had gone mysteriously missing the same weekend that he was murdered. The town easily put the pieces together. Not even a week later, the secretary's body was found in the nearby Harpeth River. The scandal rocked the entire state. Thomas's mother hadn't made a public appearance since the murders. She stayed holed up in their mansion, rumored to be eating pills like popcorn and washing it down in the depths of the wine cellar. I saw her a few times, peeking through the curtains of a bay window from up there at that cursed house, making sure Thomas and I made our way safely. Even from far away, she looked like a ghost, her pale face standing out harshly against all that black around her. Most of the time, I wouldn't even dare gaze up there when at the gate. As for Thomas, he was pulled from the private school he attended in the city and became homeschooled after the tragedy. He had a string of nannies and tutors that took care of him, none of which stayed for more than a couple months. In spite of everything, I had admired his attitude. He seemed to always hold himself high when I was around him. Although we never really talked about any of his family troubles, I could tell that he was learning to be independent and resilient, knowing that whatever became of his life would be from his own hands. Well, that and the millions and millions he stood to inherit. I guessed that, although he had lost his childhood, at least he'd make some money back from it. Now, as I waited at the gates of any child's hell, I could see him descending the driveway. We were the same age, so his black suit was probably about the same size as mine, though it was surely about the cost of my parents' monthly mortgage bill. My eyes wandered up to the mansion behind him and immediately locked onto his mother's ghastly white face in the window. I shot my eyes down to my feet, cursing myself for looking so clumsily. Oh, goodness. I could see how sunken and dark her eyes were. Why was her mouth wide open like she was screaming? Why did I look? Damn it, why did I look? I had to pull myself together as Thomas approached the other side of the gate and it began to open outward toward me. He was a little taller than me, with dark hair gelled and combed neatly back against his head. In his left hand, he held several light purple flowers. He walked through the gate and up to me. He gave me a tight-lipped, squinty-eyed, freckled smile and extended his right hand. "A good morning to you, sir," he said aristocratically, the inflection in his voice spiking immediately, then dropping as low as a prepubescent boy can squeak. I shook his hand and bowed. "And to you, my good man?" I matched his energy. We laughed off the bit, and I lightly smacked his shoulder. "How you doing, dude?" "I'm good. Be a lot better if it wasn't so damn cold. Doesn't make any sense." "I know. What are those?" I turned my gaze toward his floral fistful. "These are Siberian irises. I was going to use Yarrows, but with the cold snap, I think these will hold up a little better. Do you mind if I stop by and see Dad before church? He said with a slightly concerned brow. Oh, man, not at all. That's fine. I was surprised, since Thomas had never proposed a visit to his father's grave, at least not while I was with him. I made sure my body language showed him that it was indeed all fine with me. Okay, thanks. You better get going then. As the gate slowly closed, we walked out of Thomas's driveway and back onto the road. We followed the bend down into town, catching up with each other, talking about school and books and March Madness. We passed more and more houses as we got closer to the heart of town, being greeted by a couple of residents we knew. A man named Gail Carruthers, who was in his early 90s, told us that we looked sharp. Tammy Hill, mother of another boy our age, Dylan, was getting out of her car with a grocery bag and walking up to her house as we passed by. She said hello and that she would be a couple minutes late to church on account of getting everything chopped up and in the crock pot.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. CTNCs 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
We got to the sidewalk, finally, and had only a couple of closed storefronts to go before we crossed Main Street and onto church property. You really don't have to tag along if you don't want to, Thomas said, almost apologetically, stopping where the sidewalk crossed the stone pathway that led to the church's front door. People were beginning to scurry from the parking lot into the building, all wearing their finest. The large brick church stood proud and welcoming. It would only be about 30 minutes before the bells within it would ring out the Westminster Carol and services would begin.
Oh, no, if it's okay with you, I'd like to come along. I'm not really in a church-talking mood yet, I replied with a smile.
Thomas laughed.
I know what you mean. All right, cool.
The cemetery was right behind the church, and enormous. We walked on the sidewalk around the building and up to the several dozen-acre lot. The city had made it a top agenda to beautify the area and make it look as un-cemetery-like as possible, planting hundreds of trees, ironically converting it into a haunted forest. Thomas and I began walking through the Garden of Death. I put my hands in my pockets, both because of the chill and also for the sudden nervousness and realization of the loss of life around me. We walked past the gravestones of strangers. We also walked past the stones of people we knew, smiling faces that we used to look up and see on a weekly basis. We walked past a sad little story of a boy that was born 98 years ago and died 97 years ago.
Okay, man, isn't that much further now?
Thomas broke the silence, obviously sensing my uneasiness.
No problemo.
I weakly near whispered at my pacing dress loafers, not wanting to read any more sad stone stories along the way. I kept my eyes down a few more seconds until I realized I couldn't hear Thomas's grass steps next to me. I stopped and looked back. Thomas was frozen, one eye squinted, looking dead ahead of us. I turned that way too. About 100 feet ahead of us was a wrought iron gated in section about the size of a tennis court. A freshly painted sign at the entrance read, Sanderson, but this isn't what piqued my curiosity. Immediately inside the gate and throughout the area's entirety was a mass of mist, a pale white, ever so slowly revolving cloud. I glanced around, finding not so much as a puff of morning mist anywhere else among the stones.
Thomas?
I spat at my friend, who looked on at the phenomenon, silent and unblinking. I turned back to the gated-in weather anomaly. The ivory vapor just slowly turned and turned like a time-lapsed video of a hurricane taken from space. Then, seemingly right at the center of the mist, came a slow red glow, growing round and then tightening into a single point of light.
There's somebody in there,
Thomas stated confidently before he angrily trudged the last few dozen feet to the black iron gate entrance by the sign that bore his name.
You can stay out here. Really, it's okay,
Thomas turned back and said to me,
raising the bouquet of purple irises up almost like a toast. My hands were still sheepishly in my pockets, my face showing fear and confusion. I started. I had the out. It would be so much easier to just let Thomas go in and deal with it. It's his dad, after all. At least, it was. That was his name on the sign, not mine. Really, it was none of my business. It would actually be more respectful of me to hang back. The smaller voice in the back of my mind told me that was the fool's excuse, though. That was his friend, and his friend was choosing bravery. Thomas was going to push through and address this issue head on. I remembered the old John Wayne quote, "Courage is being scared to death, but saddling up anyway." This was an opportunity for me to be scared to death and saddle up anyway. "I'm coming with you," I finally announced, before taking my hands out of my pockets and striding quickly to catch up to Thomas at the gate entrance. My friend gave me a small, appreciative smile. We both slowly and carefully marched into the mist. We would have been walking blind if it weren't for the small, focused point of red light in front of us. It was only a water vapor that engulfed us, but the smell of smoke clung to our nostrils as well. Rich, well-seasoned tobacco smoke, along with a subtle, rotten egg smell of sulfur. The red light fell from above our heads to down around our belt area from where we could see. We slowly walked on until we came into a clearing of the mist around the center of the Sanderson family plot. We stopped. There was the gravestone of Dr. Eli Sanderson, an obsidian memorial with big white chiseled letters. It stood about 5 feet tall. A man stood there too. He had an elbow rested on the top of Dr. Sanderson's rock. He rose up at least 6'6". He wore a beige seersucker suit with a wide-brimmed white hat and matching shoes. He was slightly overweight for his height, probably 260-odd pounds heavy. He was older, and it seemed he was bald under that flashy white hat. He wore black circular glasses, held up by a pale, pointy nose and low-lobed ears. He flashed us a mouth full of immaculate pearl-white veneers. He held a cigarette up near that smile, the source of the mysterious red glow. He pulled it to his mouth and breathed in at the butt of it. To my amazement, I saw both ends of the cigarette glow into a dull flame. He then held it away from his face again and pursed his thin lips into an O and pushed out several smoke rings that grew and grew until they joined the rest of the slowly swirling cloud around them. We just stood and watched in surprise until Thomas spoke up. "Who are you?" he said at a volume that was trying to display confidence. The stranger wasn't persuaded.
"Boys, it's all right now."
He took his elbow off of Dr. Sanderson's gravestone and began toward Thomas and I. He took a cigarette, pinched in his right hand, and placed it into his left hand, which closed up into a fist, somehow painlessly extinguishing it. Upon opening his left hand, the cigarette had disappeared. Soon he was standing over Thomas and I with a big, toothy grin that would make any salesman proud. He stuck out a pale, fleshy handshake, first to Thomas and then to me. His skin was shockingly ice cold.
"My name is Ello Kingfisher. I assume one of the two of you to be Thomas Sanderson, no?"
His voice was low and rumbling, fitting for a man of his size. He had a matter-of-fact, magnolia moonlight southern accent. Thomas and I shared an anxious glance and remained silent.
"It's okay, boys, really. Speak up now," he politely commanded down at us.
"I'm Thomas Sanderson. What do you want, sir?" Thomas flatly replied in a question that was more of an accusation.
"Thomas, Thomas, Thomas, my boy. I was wondering when I'd finally get to meet you, son."
Kingfisher leaned down and took my friend's hand again in a stronger, longer shake. He retracted and put his hands on his hips, which boasted a large, silver horseshoe belt buckle. "Who are you?" Thomas repeated, with more bass in his voice than when he had asked the first time.
"I've done told you that, son. I'm Ello Kingfisher. I'm an old retired fortune teller of sorts. A soothsayer, they've called me too. I know I don't quite appear how you would imagine an old fortune teller to look. That's because, my boys, I am a real one. Shameful the stereotype that's emerged over the decades. The forehead beads and glass balls and what have you. Oh well, phooey that. All that. And Thomas Sanderson, I was a good, dear friend of your father's. He once again flashed us a bone-white smile. I thought for a moment that I could briefly see a soft red glow behind each of his tinted circular lenses. Daddy never mentioned you, and I've never seen you either, Thomas corrected the man. Oh, your father and I worked together long before you were born, son. Kingfisher's toothy smile relaxed and his face became more stern. We had some dealings far back ago when he wasn't doing too well. You understand? I had never heard of the Sandersons ever being less than rich, so this statement took me by surprise. I turned to Thomas, whose cheeks had turned slightly red out of either anger or embarrassment, or both. Either way, he didn't seem confused by Kingfisher's words. What do you want? Thomas softly barked. Well, boy, I'll try my best to put it to you quickly. Kingfisher began in on a story, and also in a slow pace around the clearing of the mist. Your father came to me when he was a young man, see? He was a poor, young soul, truly. How he found me, I won't ever probably know. But he did find me, Thomas. He came to me. You must understand that. This was back in the heyday of my fortune-telling days. This was back when I was really sharp. I could surely give a man his future. At my best, and for the right man, I could even craft his future. Whatever he wanted, as long as he took my bestowed gift and made the world a more evil place in its wake. That's what I get out of this, you see. Kingfisher stopped his pacing and came over to us again, lowering his head to accentuate the certainty behind his words. There, behind his glasses, and this time brighter than before, his eyes did light up an angry red. I began to feel very nervous. I shot a quick look over to Thomas again. His eyes were open, a little wider than they'd been before, like he was filling up with a fearful realization. So Eli Sanderson and I made a deal. I was at the top of my game, and his devilish potential was too sugary to deny, so I formed together a wonderful, fortunate future for your father. He got it all, too. Every last bit of what I had told him would happen. And what did he do to me, Thomas? What did he do? Kingfisher began to sound angry, his voice becoming more graveled, and the burning circles behind his glasses more inflamed as he talked down to my friend. What? Thomas replied, intimidated but genuinely curious to hear where this was going. He broke the rules of our deal. You see, with my agreements are certain stipulations to ensure a maximum return on my end. I gotta know that the men I work with will drain as much goodness out of this world as possible. He broke the stipulation, snapped it at its roots. Then he died, Thomas. He died before he could uphold himself to yours truly. He had until the end of his rich, tasty life to give me what he owed me, you see. Got himself shot to hell long before he was supposed to go. That's a problem for me, Thomas. A big problem. What am I supposed to do about it? Thomas said, half defiantly. Why are you telling me any of this? I'm very glad you asked, son. Kingfisher began pacing again and stuck a hand into a pocket on the interior of his beige seersucker jacket. He pulled out another cigarette and set it between his lips. He didn't light it. He merely sucked in tightly and the thing lit up at both ends. This confirmed what was already swirling in my mind, just like the white fog that was swirling around me. L.O. Kingfisher was not a man. He was something else, and he meant harm. You see, when I met your father, he was an eternal bachelor, Kingfisher continued, accentuating the word eternal with a flapping of his free hand that wasn't holding the spontaneously lit cigarette.
His cadence had become more like that of an old-time tent revival sermon.
That was our deal, you see. He would have all the wealth and power and privilege that he could ever want, but the one thing he couldn't do was ever marry. What do you reckon he did to me, Thomas? What do you reckon he did to my perfectly tailored future I'm made for him?
Thomas remained silent, not wanting to state the obvious.
Yes, exactly. He married your mama. Now, usually this would nullify the deal, but I, being the gracious old imp that I am, and seeing all the delicious evil that your father's fortunes had turned on this world, I returned to him with an ultimatum. He would simply kill his wife, and then we would be back to fair and square.
My hands shook, so I plunged them back into my pockets. Looking at Thomas, I could see his eyes twitching as his gaze remained locked into Kingfisher's shaded, boiling red stare.
Did he do that, Thomas? Did he uphold his end of a so mercifully augmented arrangement?
Hell no, he didn't, and I thank him. Thomas kept pulsating between boldness and shakiness, but I was glad to see him combating the strange man's growing anger. Kingfisher relaxed his face, gave a deep chuckle, and sucked another flame into his cigarette, blowing more rings right at the two of us boys.
I'm not usually in the business of granting chance after chance here, Tommy, but I have your father's last chance at getting flush with me. You are going to be his last chance at getting even, see?
I won't help you do anything. It seemed as though Thomas had kept his foot flexed on the bold pedal. I looked to him, and he was frowning up at Kingfisher, an icy certainty in his young eyes.
You will, my boy, and you will not deny me twice more, or else this entire deal will be nullified.
The fortune teller erupted into a smoky-voiced warning over my friend. The fiery orbs behind his black glasses grew brighter, and then calmed along with his face.
Please, Thomas, help me help you on this one. It'll only benefit you, after all. Do you enjoy how comfortable it is? You'll never have to work a day in your life or worry about a single crisp dollar in all of your years. You simply must uphold your father's end of the deal. You must kill your mother, Thomas.
His voice had returned to an almost sweet sincerity.
I won't do that. I can never do that,
Thomas said, as if he had seen this proposal coming a mile away. His voice had a slight tremble that I had not heard before. Kingfisher puffed out his chest and once again crushed his cigarette into his fist, somehow blanking it from existence again. He took a big, angry inhale. I could see protruding blue veins underneath the pale skin on his neck and temples.
Now, boy, that's twice now you've denied me. Do you understand the power of your words, son? You haven't even heard me out fully, and you're one statement away from ending everything. Just hear me out. I'm not an unreasonable man, Thomas. Notice how I'm here only now, much time after your father died in the first place? I wanted to give you time to grieve and grow before I threw such a task on you. Just do me a favor, reach into your left side pocket.
Kingfisher squatted down to eye level with Thomas, who did lower his left hand into his trousers and pulled out an orange pill bottle. He held it up to his eyes.
What is it, Thomas?
I whispered through a layer of fear-induced phlegm, having not used my voice for the past several minutes.
It's my mom's Xanax refill,
he whispered back with a heavy, defeated tone.
Well, not just any Xanax refill,
Kingfisher proudly boomed from his squat.
This is a special recipe that I've cooked up in the past, chemically identical to your mama's medicine, untraceable by investigation. Yet, her usual dose, or her double or triple dose, as I would expect, will be enough to take her down, son. It's that easy.
He remained eye to eye with Thomas, the color behind his frame suddenly a cooler, bluish tone, friendlier. He curved a warm smile to Thomas and clapped a heavy hand to his shoulder. Thomas flinched at the contact.
Come on, boy. You think she's living now as it is? She won't go out due to the scandal of it all. She coops herself up in that mansion and dies a little every day. Won't you be helping her out? Trust me, compared to my colleagues and their wretched ways, this is a very easy deal for you.
He closed a large, pale hand around Thomas's that held the pill bottle.
Take it to her. She'll be none the wiser. It'll all be over, and I'll be out of your hair forever and ever, amen.
His face curled up into another big, scheming smile. The hues behind his dark glasses once again showed red. Thomas stood there, staring into his closed hand. He remained that way for almost 20 seconds, unmoving and silent. The white fog around us continued to slowly swirl. L.O. Kingfisher stood back up and put his hands in his pockets, not taking his focus off of Thomas, waiting for a response. After what seemed like an hour to me, Thomas suddenly sprang into action. He raised up the little pill bottle and threw it to the ground in front of him, then took his right foot and stomped it into shards of plastic, crushing most of the little white pills into powder.
No, I will not do this! I will not kill my mom just to keep the money! No, no, no!
Thomas broke out into a shout, further stomping on the would-be murder weapon. Kingfisher's eyes grew as bright and as angry red as ever, but his face remained a strange calm. He gave Thomas a close-lipped smile.
Then there it is, Thomas. There it is. That's a third denial if I ever heard one.
He spoke softly and assuredly. I turned and saw tears pouring out of Thomas's eyes. I threw an arm around his shoulder. I heard myself speak up to the big man.
You aren't anything but some old crazy trickster. Thomas is stronger than you'll ever be.
My friend's courage had somehow bled into me. I was scared to death, but saddled up anyway.
Shut up, boy. You're out of this. Yeah, sure, he's a mighty little nugget for his age, but he really should let me finish. You see, losing the money was the least damning part of all this for him.
Thomas wiped his eyes and looked up into the lit charcoal that sizzled behind Kingfisher's black circle frames. Once again, he looked confused.
What?
See, boy, I've been retired from the fortune-telling business a long time, but every now and then I can spit out a spare dandy. You, my friend, just put a brand new fortune into motion for yourself.
He squatted back down and was face to face with a wide-eyed Thomas, whose frightened look was reflected in Kingfisher's lenses.
Oh, yes, I see it now.
Kingfisher flew out an arm at Thomas and snatched his hand like an eagle captures a field mouse. His voice changed into an almost sing-songy performative timbre.
You will return to your allotted life and you will experience all of the same prosperity you're accustomed to. You will finish schooling, and you will excel in your studies. You will go on to Stanford University, where you will soar above your peers with intellect and prowess. There, you will meet the love of your life. Together, you will both make great strides in the world of business.
I stole a look over to Thomas, whose pupils had paled, like he was spinning into a hypnosis upon hearing the words of the fortune teller. So far, I was pleasantly optimistic of my friend's foretold life. Kingfisher kept on, the red growing brighter and brighter behind his shades.
You will move to the sunny coast, having the business opportunity and the financial power to pick any seaside mansion you could ever desire. You will sell your father's mansion here in town. You will take in your mother, who will become healthier and healthier as she spends more and more time away from that old place. From today, Thomas, you will experience 14 years of wonder and of effortless success. 14 complete years. On the first day of the 15th year, you will be comfortable in a corner office of a large building with your name on it. There, you will get a phone call. On the other side of that line will be a voice that will deliver bad news to you. Bad, bad, awful news.
Kingfisher's mouth sprang open, and he flashed those big square veneers at Thomas, whose eyes were still milky in the trance of it all.
Oh, this news will break you, boy. It will break you to bits. You will hang that phone up, reach into your desk, and pull out an unopened bottle of single malt scotch whiskey. You will sit there and drink the entire damned thing. You will vomit all over the Turkish carpet in your corner office. Then, needing to further quench your thirst, you will trip and stumble out of that big building with your name on it, waving off concerned employees. You will stagger over to your hot red sports car and get in. Somehow, you will make it to the liquor store, where you will buy another bottle of single malt scotch whiskey. You will sit in your car and drink the entire damned thing. You will try your absolute best to drive home after that. You'll take the curved coastal highway. Of course, you won't get far. The first big bend of the road, and you'll swerve your drunkard ass right into the path of a packed van. You will black out, and then reawake as you choke on thick black smoke. You will fight your way out of the wreckage, mostly unharmed. You will take a grand look at the twisted, burning metal mess you made. Sitting in the back of the van will be two black, burnt children's bodies. Luckily for you, Thomas, they will be killed on impact. The victims in the front, however, won't be so lucky. The father of the two charred children will be sitting at the squashed-in steering wheel. He'll raise a broken forearm to his neck, his windpipe having been crushed by his seatbelt. He will slowly turn to his side and see his wife, who will be gurgling and groaning in fatal pain as she looks down to see her sternum poking bloody out of her chest like an ivory spear. Bug-eyed, the two parents will look at each other and their respective wounds before they notice the fire coming from the back of their vehicle. Only upon turning toward it will they realize they have lost their children. The noises you will hear them make will radiate through your bones and sting your ears for all of time, Thomas. All of time. You'll just be sitting there, drunk as sin, sitting on the shoulder of that twisted coastal road. The two parents in the front seat of that van will turn to look at you. The whites of their eyes will stretch at you with horrible realization. They will know it was you, Thomas. They will know. They will continue that hellish wailing of loss as the fire rages behind them. They will be stuck right in their seats. They will know their escape is impossible. The father will ache his broken forearm into the somehow opened glove box. He will reach in for a gun and find it, although it will burn him to the touch. He will fight the blinding pain and put that gun up to his ear. Right as he will cock that pistol, the entire car will erupt into an explosion. You will sit there and see the parents violently convulsing and hollering in the unreal pain of the flames. You will sit there, and you will live with that image for all time. You will lose everything, everything, and more. My mouth had fallen open a while ago, and I had just stared, frozen by Kingfisher's words. Thomas had started to shudder under my arm. Kingfisher got out of his squat and stood tall and proud. "Well, there you have it, son. I bid you a good day." He patted his jacket and then pulled out a third cigarette and sucked a flame into it, all while giving us his flashiest, toothiest smile yet. He walked back over to the gravesite of Dr. Eli Sanderson. "Should have just did it my way, Thomas." Thomas finally broke his silence. "Are you the devil?" he asked, but he seemed to not have a doubt about it. He continued to tremble as I kept my arm over his shoulder. He felt cold. The fog around us began to swirl faster and faster and faster. Kingfisher burst into a big, thunderous laugh. His eyes behind his circular lenses were as bright red as they had been this whole time. He slapped his knee with the hand that wasn't holding the smoldering little cigarette. The white mist turned and turned. "No, son, I'm not the devil. But next time I see you, Thomas Anderson, I will introduce you to him personally." With this, the fog spun and spun ever more quickly. The fortune teller, L.O. Kingfisher, walked backward into the spiraling wall,
disappearing from sight, save for one last glow from his cigarette, along with two burning red coal eyes. Soon, those lights were gone too. In an instant, the fog itself dissipated, leaving the two boys back in the normal but chilly spring morning. They both looked around, making sure the man was really gone. Nothing so much as twitched around the entire cemetery. I kept my arm around Thomas. Then, right on cue, the church bells chimed out the Westminster Carol. It was time to go. "Hey, don't worry about that, buddy. It's all gonna be okay. Listen to me, I mean it. Don't worry about a thing." Thomas put his gaze to the ground. "Let me take care of this, and then let's get out of here." He had held on to the Siberian irises throughout that entire affair, so he took them and walked over to his dad's grave and set them on the ground right in front of it. "Rest easy, Pops." The two of us then walked back through the wooded cemetery and on toward our church, where we would act like nothing ever happened. It's safe to say that the next 14 years were the best of Thomas's life.
How to have fun anytime, anywhere. Step one, go to ChumbaCasino.com.
ChumbaCasino.com. Got it.
Step two, collect your welcome bonus.
Come to Papa, welcome bonus.
Step three, play hundreds of casino-style games for free.
That's a lot of games, all for free.
Step four, unleash your excitement.
Woohoo!
Chumba Casino has been delivering thrills for over a decade. So claim your free welcome bonus now and live the Chumba life. Visit ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
You've just heard The Fortune Teller by Sam Morris. Sam Morris is a lifelong writer, just not in the usual sense. He was born to a musical family and has played piano and sang his entire life. He has also written songs for over 20 years. Having been a lifetime horror fan, he first started writing short stories in 2022 and instantly loved it as a creative outlet, especially since it was so different from his usual world of music. Translating the art of songwriting into the form of short stories has proven very therapeutic to Sam, who must reach into the darker parts of his mind and exorcise the monsters that live there. And now, dear listeners, from author A.W. Mason, here's The Arm Thief. The cut seemed clumsy. Bits of skin and muscle hung from the shoulder joint like the frays of a colorful piñata. A piñata beaten by an assembly of ravenous, celebrating children. Robertson knelt, his shadow casting a dark silhouette over the body. "What do you think, Gannon?" he asked, looking up at his partner. The bright morning sun began to bake the cool earth. Gannon wiped the sweat from the back of his neck with a bandana. He could tell it was going to be an unusually hot summer, even for Florida. "Shoot, is that who I think it is?" It was the third body they had found in as many weeks, all missing the right arm. The chip started as many other technological advances had. There were the early adopters, the early majority, the folks who thought it posh to go around using computer components embedded in their arms to complete such mundane tasks as grabbing an overpriced cup of coffee. Higher-ups, very important people, used it as a status symbol. Eventually, however, like television sets in the 1990s or personal computers in the mid-2000s, just about everyone ended up having one. "You know damn well who it is. He doesn't need both arms for us to tell it's Senator Timmons." A play on the credit card tap system that garnered some popularity years before. The chip contained every piece of personal data worth having, encrypted and stored, without the chance of losing it or having it stolen. Or so it was thought. Everything from social media passwords to social security numbers and credit card numbers could be scanned at the grocery store, the mall, the bank, even online, using a special at-home scanning device, with a wave of the right forearm, whether said arm was connected or not. The chip killings started hot and heavy, and at first, only the wealthy had targets on their backs, or rather, forearms. Word got around, spread like wildfire, that those with money were getting the chip implants. Then,
A body showed up in a dirty alley, half covered with trash and missing its arm from the elbow down. Then another body floated to the surface of the Sarpy River, also missing most of an arm. Then another, and another. The fact that the technology survived even after the first rash of chip killings should have been a testament to how much technology had affected humankind. "And I suppose you noticed the other thing too, then," Robertson conceded as he looked up at his partner, shielding his eyes from the rising sun. But the technology persisted, and the chip killings tapered off. The chances of stalking a victim, putting in the work to remove the forearm housing the chip, and finding out he or she was more in debt than the federal government had started to tarnish the lucrative heists that, formerly, would guarantee a big payday. "Unfortunately, the good senator is missing his entire right arm. Doesn't look like a chip killing. Otherwise, he'd just be missing his forearm. Guessing that's why we're here," Gannon said. Behind them, a small crowd had gathered, cut off by a line of yellow police tape. By lunchtime, news channels would be all over the senator's death, like the flies already drunkenly buzzing around his open wound. "Seems that way, but if it's not an extension of the chip killings, someone's going through an awful lot of trouble to remove the right arms of their victims just for fun," Robertson replied. He stood up, his knees creaking like old hinges. "Looks like we have a serial killer to catch." After the crime scene was cleared and the victim tagged and bagged, Robertson and Gannon retired to their desks to work on their reports for the day. The two had been partners going on 20 years, and in that time solved many cases together, each turning down promotions that would relocate them, and relocate their tax bracket as well, to remain together. Although Robertson, a lifetime bachelor, lived alone, he took dinner with Gannon and his wife a few times a week, and it suited both of them just fine. Neither would have children, but the job acted as a surrogate for their attention. As he chewed on the eraser of his pencil, a bad habit he'd had since grade school, Robertson pored over the notes he and Gannon had collected up until that day. He was certain somewhere in the thousands of words, hundreds of photographs, and hours of surveillance footage that a connection existed. Not only to Senator Timmons' demise, but to the two other victims as well. But for now, one thing linked them together. An entire right arm missing from their bodies. "I still don't think we should entirely rule out that this could be a string of copycat killings," Gannon said. His brown dress shoes were propped up on his desk as he leaned back in his chair, nose deep in a puzzle book. "And I know what you're gonna say. The whole arm is missing. When the chip killings were hot, the victims were just missing their forearms, where the chips were. So much less work, less muscle and bone to cut through." Gannon chuckled. "What you're going to say is that. It's different, but maybe this is a new version of an old crime." He put down the word jumble he was working on and sighed. Robertson pulled a sheet of paper out from two separate manila files and set them side by side. With an index finger extended on each hand, he let them fall to the paper and scanned its contents. His eyes darted back and forth, absorbing the data on each page. The sound of an oscillating fan, on its last leg 2 years prior, wheezed from its perch atop a steel filing cabinet. Open windows and fans didn't start to become popular around the precinct until at least early June. But the old, air-conditionerless building began to show early signs of an approaching Indian summer. But one other thing disturbs me. When was Vic number one found?" Robertson asked. He knew, had it memorized, as he had most other odds and ends of each victim. Gannon humored him. "March 7th. Want to take a stab at when the Vic's credit card trail went cold? March 6th? Robertson smiled and touched his index finger to his nose. "Now, how about Vic number two?" Gannon again knew the answer. "April 2nd. I'm guessing that her credit card transaction stopped the day before, too?" "March 31st, actually. She didn't get a chance to perform any capitalistic duties the day before we found the body. Who says you can't pay attention and do crossword puzzles at the same time?" In the corner, a tall detective with a wide chest and a bald spot the size of Cincinnati struggled to fill his paper cup from the office water jug. It gurgled and hissed as the last of the water sloshed into the wax cone braced between the detective's thumb and finger. We already know all this, and I bet when we get the credentials back on the senator yesterday, or the day before, will be the last time his chip or credit card was used as well. Where are you going with this, Joe? Gannon asked his partner. And by the way, puzzles keep the mind young. Robertson breathed heavily through his nose and gathered up the two sets of bank statements, putting them back in their respective folders. It's May 6th, and neither chip has been used since either body was discovered. Do you think there's a perp out there just holding on to two fetid, rotting arms for the right time to use them? If these were copycat killings, wouldn't we already be seeing some financial movement? The fan atop the filing cabinet surged and almost quit, blades catching again to continue its oscillating death march. Gannon looked up to the ceiling tile, seeming to contemplate his partner's question. It did make sense. I'm just saying that we should keep an open mind, Gannon said. And I'm saying we need to put our noses back in these files until we hear from the medical examiner about our friend Timmons. So, the two detectives again cleared their desks and laid down the information and evidence gathered from the first two victims in hopes of finding a connection, one that could potentially tie in the senator's death and find their murderer. Victim 1, Adam Severson, 33, date of birth, January 4th, 1999. Body found on March 7th, 2032. Approximate date of death, March 6th, same year. Cause of death? Blood loss due to antemortem appendage amputation. Occupation, warehouse manager. Last seen leaving a home improvement store on March 6th. Robertson had the task of interviewing Severson's widow, Anna. He was also survived by a child, a son named Adam Jr., 7 years old. According to Anna, her husband was a family man. He worked full-time, Monday through Friday, and coached his son's t-ball team during the spring. They did not go to church, weren't deeply religious, but the family tried to make it a habit to eat dinner together every night and give their son the best life they could. The Seversons weren't a wealthy bunch, but both Adam and Anna had a 401k at work, a little bit of savings in the bank. That was eventually to become Adam Jr.'s college fund, and knew how to live within their means. Not exactly a likely target for a chip killing, but if the killer seemed desperate enough, the motive could fit. Anna confirmed that her husband had no known enemies and only hung out with a few friends from work when he wasn't at home with his family. He had recently contemplated going back to school and finishing his bachelor's degree so he could move up within his company. For all intents and purposes, Adam Severson lived a normal, if not at times averagely boring, life. These statements were also backed up by interviews received from work colleagues and other T-ball parents. The only thing of note, and the only time a suspect was ever considered, however short-lived that may have been, was an altercation caught on camera in the parking lot of a Gas and Go that occurred around noon on March 6th while Adam was on his lunch break. Surveillance footage shows Severson walking out of the convenience store and discarding a wrapper that ended up fluttering away from the trash receptacle and onto the ground. He is then approached by another man named Henry Albright, and an argument ensues, based on Albright's statement, about throwing trash on the ground. 10 seconds later, the men begin to shove each other. Albright tries to bear hug Severson, and Severson elbows him in the face, knocking Albright to the ground. Severson leaves the frame, drives back to work, and Albright picks up the piece of trash and places it in the receptacle. Time clock records show Albright clocking back into work 7 minutes after the Gas and Go incident, verified by co-workers, so Albright did not pursue Severson. Time clock records also show Albright clocking out of work at his normal time of 5 p.m., and from there, went home for the evening, where neighbors say they believe that his vehicle stayed in the driveway of his home all that night. Severson left work around the same time, 5 p.m., but traveled to a local hardware store called Jake's to pick up items for a home renovation project, and that was where the trail ran cold. There were no surveillance cameras outside of the hardware store, and his purchase, recorded via chip, was his last interaction on paper. His body and vehicle were found the next day on the outskirts of the Sugar Mill Woods, a half hour or so drive from the city. Did the junior detectives follow up on Albright? Did he have an alibi for Vic number 2? Gannon asked Robertson, who was now studying the second victim's file. Yes and yes. Albright was again home the night Ms. Agnew was slain, once more corroborated by neighbors who believe his car was still in the driveway that night, too. Unless something damning comes back from the senator's examination, Albright isn't a fit. Let's go over Agnew's file. Victim 2, Gloria Agnew, 47. Date of birth, September 25th, 1984. Body found on April 2nd, 2032. Approximate date of death, April 1st, same year. Cause of death, blood loss due to antemortem appendage amputation. Occupation, executive controller, BioWaste Corp. Last seen leaving a restaurant on April 1st. Ganning completed this interview, which occurred with Mrs. Agnew's work colleagues. Agnew was unmarried and lived in a luxury high-rise downtown. She had interned at BioWaste Corp straight out of college and earned her master's in business with a work scholarship. She excelled at each position she held and was generally liked by her co-workers, although it was documented in more than one interview that she had a ruthless streak in her when it came to getting work done when need be. Regardless, the little spats that came about from time to time did not factor into her death, according to Gannon's logic. Agnew was also an only child and had an estranged relationship with her father, who resided in a nursing home in upstate New York, and her mother died from cancer over a decade prior. The potential suspect pool for Agnew seemed even smaller. A week before her death, Agnew had closed a big deal with a string of regional hospitals and received not only a large bonus for doing so, but a promotion to company controller. On the night of April 1st, Agnew and several work colleagues met at Anthony's Steakhouse for a celebratory dinner and drinks. Records show Agnew staying until 8:30 p.m. that evening, cashing out, but her colleagues picking up her portion of the tab, then leaving the building shortly thereafter. Surveillance footage shows her exiting, walking around the side of the building where witnesses say she parked, but the cameras did not have angles covering that part of the lot. At this point, it cannot be determined if she left in her car or was abducted, perhaps in plain sight, at the rear of the building. Her body, as well as her vehicle, were both found the next day in another section of the Sugar Mill Woods, however, many miles apart from where Severson's body was recovered. And none of her friends or co-workers that night noticed anything suspicious, correct? No one lingering around that looked out of place? Agnew wasn't acting funny at all? Robertson asked. Not according to anyone I talked to, restaurant staff included, Gannon replied. It didn't sit right with him. These kinds of cases never did. Retirement was a 10-letter word Robertson didn't think of often. To him, he would always be a detective, all he had ever aspired to be. He'd saved many lives over the years, collared countless perps, and brought solace to grieving families of victims he would never know. As haunting as many of these cases should have been, probably were to most, Robertson kept a clear head and steady mind when it came to his work. Still, he could only recall one other time a case had stumped him like this one had, bothered him deep into the marrow of his bones. That was the blue-collar butcher case. To this day, the case remained unsolved, and Mr. Blue Collar was the one that got away. The file never left the right corner of Robertson's desk, save for the few times he had picked it up, futilely flipping through its contents. A mocha-skinned woman with close black curls walked up to the two detectives spread about their desks. Neither heard her approach. "You two look like a sorry mess," she said, smiling at the men. Gannon lifted his head and smiled back. "We won't look so sorry if you have a bit of good news for us, Brenna." Brenna's smile waned, but her eyes still showed a clear admiration for the detectives, even in the cheap fluorescent light. "I have news, and whether it's good or bad is how you use it. Come on, guys, follow me back to my office," she said. Brenna's office was the medical examiner's room, also affectionately known as the meat locker, a place from which she often had to shoo away detectives and sergeants alike in the summer months when the room was a full 30 degrees cooler than the rest of the building. Behind her lone desk, Brenna's medical license and degree hung on a bland concrete wall. To the left of the desk, a wall of pull-out metal trays, the kind big enough to accommodate most adult guests, gleamed from floor to ceiling. A metal tray in the middle row protruded from the wall. The senator lay on the cold steel, a thin, light blue sheet covering him from the chest down. "When are they ever going to get you an assistant, Brenna? Don't you get tired of dealing with the dead all day long by yourself?" Gannon asked, watching as Brenna pulled down the sheet some. "I like the peace and quiet. This is the only place people don't chew my ear off with office gossip and weekend revelries. It's pretty nice," she said. The whir of the fans above them, pumping in the chilly air, filled the void of chatter. "What's the news?" Robertson asked, looking down at the body on display. "Well," Brenna began, "I can confirm that the cause of death for Mr. Timmons matches that of your first two victims. It appears as though someone hacked off his right arm here, at the shoulder joint." She pointed with a capped ballpoint pen, tracing the wound that encompassed the area where the senator's arm used to be attached. "And whoever did it used the same tool as before. I compared the cuts between Severson and Agnew. The same slicing pattern showed up on the muscles and ligaments, as well as the groove pattern left on the bones. And of course, Timmons' arm was removed while he was still quite alive. He died due to blood loss." For as cool as the room had been, Robertson started to feel a warmth beneath his cheeks. It was a formality, these autopsies, but he knew deep down, and had a good guess Gannon shared his sentiment, that Timmons would indeed be the third victim of a killer they were no closer to finding than they were when they discovered Severson's body. "However, I did find two very, and I'd underline that word, very interesting things while examining the body." Robertson and Gannon looked at each other, brows raised. "Well, we like interesting. At this point, I might even take mildly stimulating," Gannon said. Smirking at that remark, Brenna walked over to a steel table and grabbed a small object. "While I was searching through the wound, I found these." Brenna handed Robertson a glass vial, the size of an old film canister, with bits of black serrated metal inside. Each piece was no bigger than a child's fingernail. The detective shook the vial. It rattled, making a dull thudding sound. "What are they exactly?" Robertson asked as he held them up to the ceiling lights. "That's what I wondered as well when I tweezed them out of Timmons' wound. But after I pulled a few out and started to line them up, I realized it's a blade. You're holding your murder weapon." Robertson tossed the vial to Gannon, who took his turn looking at the bits of steel. He scratched his stubbly chin with his free hand. "What's this orange speckling all over the pieces?" he asked. "Good eye, detective. I wondered that myself, so I did a little digging, and I arranged the pieces again. Found more of them in the senator after a second look. There was enough of that orange paint on the blade pieces to make out a brand name. It's a blade from a Rialta hand tool, a cheap Chinese knockoff of the big brands. It fits a sawzall, but blades are proprietary," Brenna said. Gannon handed the vial back to her. "Every hardware store in a 50-square-mile radius probably carries those," he said. "How much do you love me, sugar?" Brenna asked. Gannon blushed, and now his cheeks felt warm in the chilly space. "That tool had such a bad initial public offering that only one hardware store in town decided to carry it. Have you heard of a place called Jake's?" Brenna asked. Robertson and Gannon again looked at each other. The name ought to have sounded familiar. It was the last place Severson was seen alive. Did the killer shop at the same store? Was it a chance encounter, buying the blades while Severson perused the store, knowing he would then use them to commit the heinous act of murder? "Brenna, darling, I think you may have just cracked this case wide open. Have you ever thought about pulling your desk out to the bullpen and blowing the dust off a few cold cases? God knows we could use the help," Gannon said. He was already walking toward the door. "We need to get down to Jake's before they close and run a list of purchases for that particular sawzall for, say, the past 12 months. I think that ought to give us a good pool to start with." Robertson placed a hand on Brenna's white-coated shoulder. "Thank you, Brenna. This will point us in the direction we need to go. I know it will. We owe you. Big time." He smiled, then turned and walked toward his partner, who was already halfway out the door. "Did you still want to hear about the second interesting thing?" Brenna asked, projecting her voice across the frigid room. The detectives paused and looked back toward the medical examiner. I scanned Mr. Timmons, as well as searched through the registry. He never had the chip installed. Whoever took his arm isn't going to get much for it.
Gannon and Robertson pulled into Jake's well before closing time. Outside, unnamed birds sang and zoomed between the branches of a row of old oaks flanking the hardware store. Robertson put the vehicle in park and opened his door to get out. Gannon stayed in his seat and stared through the windshield at the store.
"You're right, you know," Gannon said. He turned and looked at his partner. "If Timmons didn't have a chip, these wouldn't be copycat killings. I suppose I should have been on board with that from the beginning."
He exited the passenger side and walked with Robertson to Jake's front door. "Let's just hope Brenna was right about these blades." A bell rang as the detectives entered the store. It smelled of pine dust and new plastic, not an entirely unpleasant aroma. The aisles, devoid of clientele, had stocked shelves featuring hand tools, plumbing fittings, balsa wood, and power tools. On an end cap, three rows in, a giant display of lime-green Rialta Sawzall tools dominated the scenery. Below it hung copious amounts of the same black blade from earlier, bright orange text running the length of the steel. The detective seemed drawn to the presentation as if it were magnetic.
"It looks snazzy, but I can't advise purchasing one unless you only plan on using it once or twice,"
a voice from behind them said. The man, dressed in a red vest, sidled up to the detectives looking at the power tool.
"They're cheap Chinese junk. Not sure what possessed Jake to purchase so many. They've been sitting here forever. Hell, we can't even seem to give them away. Motor burns out after a few hours, and the blades are good for one, maybe two decent projects before they start chipping and breaking apart. If you fellows are in the market, right down here we have some pretty tough Sawzall tools."
"So you haven't sold many of these then?" Robertson asked. He looked down at the red-vested man's name tag, then added, "Steve?" Steve paused and looked back at the detectives and saw the shields clipped to their belts.
"I suppose you two aren't looking to make any purchases today," Steve said.
"Sorry, buddy, just looking for information that might help in a case we're working on," Gannon said. Steve nodded, a serious look flashing across his face. He straightened himself up, stood a little taller, and smoothed out his vest.
"At your service then, detectives. You know, I actually thought about joining the force too. Thought I always had the mind for it."
"How many of these have you sold in the past 12 months?" Robertson said, pointing at the gaudy display. The more he looked at the end cap, the more it looked out of place. It almost started to become obscene.
Steve smiled. "Follow me."
He led them to the register, which was more of a computer than a money-collecting machine. Steve tapped his fingers on the register screen and started scrolling through menu options.
"Jake had us upgrade our sales system a few years back, which is great because now we can keep historical records of purchases. Makes it much easier to process returns and keep track of inventory. Just give me 1 minute and I'll pull up the Rialta."
A buzzing emanated from the inside of Gannon's jacket pocket. He pulled out his cell phone and looked at the notification. He shook his head and nudged Robertson with his elbow, showing him the screen.
"Looks like news of the senator's death is starting to cycle," Gannon said, looking back down at his phone.
A news article headline reading, "Albert Timmons found dead, EPA bill in limbo," filled the screen, along with an outdated headshot of the senator. Behind the sales counter, Steve continued to scroll through the inventory transactions. Robertson took his partner's phone and continued reading. He made it halfway through the article before he read the words that started to connect the dots between Agnew and Timmons. The bill, presented by Senator Timmons, now unexpected to pass, would have allowed phosphate companies to use several private waterways to dump radioactive byproducts. He scrolled farther down. Providence Incorporated, a subsidiary of Bio Waste Corp, backed the bill, throwing not only their support behind it, but millions of dollars as well.
"Ah, here we go. Wow, we sold three of these things in the past year. All around the same time, too," Steve said.
"Can you give us the names?" Robertson asked.
"Now, detectives, don't you need a warrant?"
Steve asked, applying his best funny guy smile. Gannon glared at Mr. Red Vest, stone-faced, eyes shooting daggers.
Okay, okay. Let me pull up the credit card receipts." Robertson handed the phone back to Gannon and told him to read the article. He scanned it and made the same link between Agnew and Timmins. When the body count rises, it's always a good news, bad news sort of situation. No detective wants to see the death toll from a string of murders increase at all. The goal is to solve the riddle, track down the killer, and let the justice system take it from there. However, the best-case scenario has a way of being edged out. Killers do get away with multiple murders, sometimes over multiple years, the most cunning of them over multiple decades. But when that happens, and the clues start off scarce and evidence is in short supply, multiple victims could turn into unseen connections. And this time, something as simple as a news article detailing the senator's backdoor dealings was the straw that started to break the proverbial camel's back. "Ah, here we go," Steve said, stopping at a section of the screen that showed the Rialta sales. "In January, we sold two, one to a Clyde Robinson, chip ID, ending in 2922. Then later that month, we sold another one to a Buck Ainge, chip ID, ending in 1537. We had a sale on them after the new year." Gannon had already put his phone away and was busy scratching down the names Steve relayed to them on a small paper notebook. "Then the last one was sold at the beginning of March to, well, looks like the last one was purchased with cash. No chip ID or name listed." It made sense. Perps with any sort of mild intelligence knew better than to leave an electronic trail. Cash was the easiest way to accomplish this, and Robertson had a feeling that the killer they were after had attained at least a slight form of cleverness. "I bet you that's our guy," Robertson said, looking at his partner. "Can you at least give us the date on which this mystery customer purchased the power tool?" That same sly smile appeared on Steve's face. "I can do you one better, detectives. Looks like our mystery shopper is eco-friendly. He had his receipt emailed to him," Steve said, and gave Gannon the email address. "See? Told you I could have been a detective."
"What about cameras? Can you access footage of when this purchase occurred?"
Steve's giddy face slackened.
"You know, Jake updated our point-of-sale system, which, like I was saying, is great. But the old man's never had cameras installed. I'm sure it's on the list."
They sat in Robertson's car as Gannon called in the email address. He had the feeling it would be a bogus account with bogus information, but it was the best lead they'd received so far on their own. The IT team put Gannon on hold while they ran the email.
"So, we have Senator Timmins trying to pass a bill that would benefit a biological waste company that employed Gloria Agnew. And the fact that who we think might be a good fit for our perp had a receipt sent to an email instead of wasting the paper to print it, well, seems like that's a big connection to me," Robertson said. "It's all environmental."
"But how does Severson fit in all this? He's just a warehouse manager. Nothing environmental tied to his company, is there?"
Gannon transferred the phone from his hand to his shoulder, holding it in place with his ear as he flipped to a clean sheet of paper in his notebook.
"Yeah, okay, go ahead."
"Uh-huh." "None, huh? No record."
"Got it. All right, appreciate the help."
Robertson looked at his partner, waiting for a response. The air conditioning blasted their damp button-ups. Sunlight beamed in through the windshield, warming their exposed flesh at the same time.
"Got a name, no address, no phone number, or connected email accounts. No record of the name, either. Probably a fake. Brian Geller Whitney. Sound familiar at all to you? Mean anything?" Gannon asked.
Mulling the name over in his head, Robertson tried connecting it to anything he'd come across so far. He threw it at the first two victims, and then to Senator Timmins, and nothing seemed to stick. He shook his head, refocused, and glanced over at his partner. Gannon had started crossing out letters in the name and rearranging them, putting them in different orders.
"For Pete's sake, do you miss your word search so much that you feel the need to try to spell out words with names now?"
Robertson asked with an uncharacteristic spat of anger. Of all the detectives back at the shop, Robertson had the easiest demeanor. Even keel and direct, yes, but for the most part he had the temper of a monk. The case, it seemed, was getting to him. Gannon appeared not to notice the outburst, eyes still on his notepad. "That suspect's name from the Severson file, Albright, what was his full name?"
Gannon asked. Robertson licked his dry lips and exhaled slowly. Henry Albright. Do you know his middle name? Did he provide one? Robertson produced his own small paper notebook, an old-timer way of keeping notes, a method that he shared with Gannon. Flipping through the pages, he settled on something toward the front and scanned his handwriting. Wayne. Said his middle name was Wayne. The pencil worked faster in Gannon's hand, filling in letters and drawing lines across the sheet. He stopped and held it out in front of his face, satisfied. He passed the notebook to his partner and watched as the word jumble started to become clear to him. It's an anagram, Joe. Brian Geller Whitney is Henry Wayne Albright. Robertson continued to stare at the notebook with its scratched-out letters and squiggly lines connecting them to other characters. A smile spread across his face, and he clapped Gannon on his shoulder. "Forget what I said about your word puzzles. You're beautiful," Robertson said, the goofy grin still plastered to his face. In his mind, he began to draw his own set of lines between Albright, Severson, and the two already connected murders. The arm amputation was just a means to an end, and also a painful, cruel way to torture and kill someone you didn't much care for. Perhaps inspired by the chip killings, or maybe just done to drive home a point about technology. But no. No, this was about the environment, the EPA bill, the radioactive phosphate. But what tripped him? What would cause Albright to snap and start a murder spree? Or was it even him? These questions bounced around Robertson's head like bingo balls in a rolling cage. There's no way Albright wasn't involved somehow. That much was obvious. And the fact that he had that skirmish with Severson the very day he was murdered, that had to mean something. But Albright wasn't much the aggressor in that fight. He sure didn't get any licks in, either. All he did was start yelling at Severson for littering. Robertson said. Come again? Littering? What do you mean? Gannon asked. What have we been missing this whole time, Gann? We've established a motive. We've started to establish a connection. Hell, we may even have our suspect back. His name connected to the murder weapon. But why? How did he start? And why was Severson killed first? Outside, the birds continued to dive between the oaks, their soundless song meant for the world beyond the cab of Robertson's car. A trigger! Gannon shouted. Littering! That was the trigger! That's what set Albright off! He watched Severson throw his trash on the ground, and that flipped a switch in his mind. He decided right there that if this man didn't do something to correct his actions, correct the actions of all humans that have contributed to pollution or the plastic islands floating out in the oceans, well, this man would pay, and he'd be the first to make a payment. For a few moments, silence hung between them as they digested their thoughts and their new lead, a lead that was apt to break the case wide open. "What time is it?" Robertson asked. Gannon looked down at the old Seiko on his wrist. 4:30. We have just enough time to go pay our friend Henry a little visit before he clocks out from work, Robertson said. Shall we? Never thought you'd ask, Gannon replied. The parking lot was nearly empty by the time Gannon and Robertson pulled into the electronics shop Albright received his paychecks from, but they arrived before quitting time all the same. With any luck, they may even catch their old, new suspect on his way to the time clock. Inside, Gannon leaned on the sales window, ringing the old metal bell on the ledge. A 20-something man walked up to the opening. "We're looking for Henry Albright. Would you be able to fetch him for us?" Gannon asked the man and flashed his shield. A puzzled look consumed the 20-something's face. "Hank? Well, he isn't here. Hasn't been here in over a week. No call, no show. Doesn't even answer his phone. I tried covering for him the first few days, clocking him in and out at the same time I did, but it started to look a little obvious when his work started piling up," the man said. In the hallway behind the sales window, several employees sauntered over to the archaic time clock affixed to the wall. With all sorts of technological advances in today's modern times, some things just never changed. The detectives watched as the employees inserted the paper cards into the time clock, stamping their hours for the day.
Is that something you do often around here? Clock in for one another? Robertson asked. The man swallowed hard and started to shake his head.
Hey, I mean, we just try to look out for each other, you know? We're not trying to cheat our boss or the company or anything. You're not going to tell, are you?
Robertson looked as if 100 light bulbs had just gone off in his head. Gannon already knew what his partner was going to ask.
Did you happen to clock Hank back into lunch on March 6th? Do you remember?
Robertson inquired. He wouldn't bet the house on this young man remembering exact dates and times, but it was worth a shot. If Albright's punches had been manipulated at all after his dust-up with Severson, it would prove that he had a certain amount of time to follow him back to where he worked, a chance to know where his victim occupied a big chunk of his day, and a chance to follow him to a hardware store later on to stalk his prey.
Actually, yeah. I clocked him back in from lunch after he called me and told me he was running a little late. I remember March 6th because it was my birthday, and I was stuck working here and a little pissed that Hank was out doing whatever he was doing. I went as far as to clock him out on time, even though he left close to an hour early. Told me he owed me. Still waiting on my birthday beer, the man said.
The final employee in line punched his time card and walked out past the sales window. He exited through a side door that sent a whoosh of warm afternoon air down the hallway. Robertson grabbed the keys from his pants pocket and turned to leave.
Thanks for the info. We'll be back if there's anything else, Gannon said, and turned to join his partner.
The man went to go punch his own time card, but looked back before the detectives pushed out the door.
If you see him, tell him he still owes me a beer.
It was almost too perfect. Just that morning, as another body turned up, Gannon and Robertson were no closer to a solid lead on a suspect as they were for a motive or a method. Some 8 hours later, not only had they been given the means, they were gifted a motive and had confirmation on their lone suspect. When they pulled up to Albright's house, his car was parked in the driveway. A good sign.
Should we call for backup? Gannon asked, scanning the perimeter of the house as he exited the vehicle.
His hand instinctively rested on the butt of his pistol, ready to be drawn from its hip holster at a second's notice.
Let's see if he's home first, Robertson said, his hand falling to the butt of his gun.
I just want to talk to him, see what we can get out of him before we go for a warrant.
As the detectives walked up the cement path to Albright's front door, a muddled noise permeated through the exterior walls. Robertson stopped, held his hand up to signal his partner to do the same, and squinted, concentrating on the noise. A certain rhythmic quality started to form, a percussive sound, then a throaty stream of... was it words? The muddled noise became clearer, the crunchy, quick guitar riffs of death metal. Albright was rocking out.
Gannon tried looking into the bay window to the right of the front door, a prickly shrub blocking his way. As he maneuvered around the staunch foliage, another throaty, muffled yell, this one several octaves higher, bled through the house. The sound sent the seasoned vet a ripple of goose flesh down his back. That wasn't heavy metal. That was agony. That was terror.
Robertson jiggled the doorknob, trying to gain entrance to Albright's house. It wouldn't budge. The detectives shared a look again, one that meant there was no time for backup. They had to act now.
The music became unbearably loud as the door flew open with one well-placed kick from Robertson. The door jamb snapped and crashed to the floor in two pieces. The house was a mess. Dirty dishes, mostly broken, scattered the stained carpeting. Tin cans that once housed baked beans and pear slices littered the dining room table beyond the couches. The music became louder as the detectives edged down the hallway, guns drawn. On the left, at the end of the hall, a bedroom door stood ajar. The source of the music came from inside the room. So did the source of the screaming. Robertson leaned back against the wall to give Gannon space to square up against the door. He took a deep breath in, let it roll through his nostrils. Robertson nodded, and Gannon shouldered into the door with a thunderous bang, barely audible above the music. Beyond the door, Albright held the bright green Rialta Sawzall in his hands and had already started to use it on the woman he had bound and gagged, tied down to an old wooden chair. A grotesque groove dug into the flesh of her right shoulder where the power tool's blade had most recently chewed. The woman's face, plastered with the wet strands of her auburn hair, looked up to Gannon, then to Robertson, pleading with her tear-filled eyes. She screamed again through the rag tied around her mouth. Gannon took all this in, the stench of the room with its old and new blood splattered against the walls and soaked in the carpet. The one window in the bedroom had been covered with a taped-up, thick-mill black trash bag. The raucous stereo, masking the noise of innocence lost and murder. He took all this in and leveled his pistol at the disheveled Albright. The perp had snapped.
"Put it down, Albright! Put it down right fucking now!" Gannon screamed.
Robertson moved to the wall opposite the man with the bright green saw and kicked the stereo plug from the wall socket. The music stopped. The only sound now was the woman's hoarse, subdued whimpering and the ridiculous noise of the saw buzzing in Albright's hand. Albright's eyes, wide and insane, stared down the detectives, then shifted to the woman, as if in an internal debate of whether to finish what he had started.
"Drop it!"
Robertson yelled next, his pistol now pointed at Albright's chest.
"You don't get it!"
Albright exclaimed. Thick strands of saliva flew from his mouth as he unleashed his verbal fury.
"They need to die! They all need to die for what they've done!"
The buzzing continued. The woman started to look ashen, woozy. Her blood loss began to show more and more as the gash in her shoulder flowed freely down her clavicle and into her armpit.
"Just put down the saw, Albright. We can talk about this. No one else has to die," Gannon said. "You don't understand! No one understands!"
Robertson flanked Albright now, trying to surround him without making him feel pinned in.
"Why don't you try to tell us, Henry? Hank? Why don't you try to explain it?"
With that, Albright's head tilted, like a dog digesting English commands. He let the saw drop to his side, but it continued its buzzing.
"They treat the world like garbage, like we're all living in one big garbage can, dumping their pollutants into the soil that grows the food that feeds our children, creating landfills and trash islands in the ocean. Entire species have gone extinct because of people like her,"
Albright said, pointing a disgusted finger at the woman on the chair. "Hank, can you turn the saw off? I think it would be a lot easier to talk. Here, look, I'm putting my gun away." Robertson holstered his pistol and raised his hands to show there wasn't any intention to harm him. Albright removed his thumb from the saw trigger, the buzzing ceasing.
"They need to pay! They need to be made examples of!" Albright continued.
The woman cried silently into the rag in her mouth. "And they will. We already know about the others you've made examples of. Senator Timmons, Gloria Agnew, Adam Severson," Robertson said. At the mention of the last name, Albright's head snapped up, alert, eyes filled with fire.
"All he had to do was pick up what he discarded so carelessly on the ground. He started all this. He's the one that made me show the others how worthless to this world they truly are,"
Albright exclaimed. "Tell you what, Hank, let's just think about all this. You can try to kill this woman, sure, but we're here now, and as soon as you try to do that, we're going to be forced to shoot you, and you'll die. Your message will never get out. People will just think it's a copycat killer, another rash of chip killings," Robertson said.
"But it's not! It's not like that at all! It was just a way of drawing attention to my selfless work!"
"I know that. My partner knows that," Gannon nodded. "You know that, and we want to make sure everyone else will know that too. Can you put down the saw? Just put it down. Let us help you. We can ride down to the station together, and you can tell us everything. Just think about it. Every news station will know your story. They'll know your name. Your message will be everywhere," Robertson pleaded. Albright stared past the detectives, eyes as blank as an empty dry erase board. He stood frozen in place, seeming to contemplate the offer. Then he spoke up.
"They'll know.
You'll let me tell them, all of them?
That's right, Robertson assured him. All of them.
And things will change. They will change,
Albright said, talking mostly to himself. That's right, son. Just put down the saw and...
You're lying. Nothing ever changes. People are sheep. This is the only way. It was always the only way.
Albright yelled into the stuffy room. At the same time he finished his outburst, the green sawzall buzzed back to life, swinging up towards the woman's head, catching her hair. Sweat-saturated strands pulled into the blade's serrated edge, ripping the hair from her scalp. In the instant that it took Albright to reactivate the power tool, Gannon adjusted his line of sight, aiming the barrel of the pistol at Albright's left shoulder, the only part of his center mass not entirely hidden behind the woman in the chair. Gannon squeezed the trigger, well aware that the shot had better be precise and on the mark. It was. The bullet tore through Albright's shoulder as the deafening bang of the discharge echoed off the cramped room's walls. The buzzing stopped, and the sawzall fell to the floor, tearing out what tangles of the woman's hair were still wrapped in the blade. Albright staggered and fell hard on his backside, stunned at what had just occurred. Robertson was on him seconds later, cuffing the man who had caused so much fear for the past few months.
"Call it in!"
Robertson roared back at Gannon. He held Albright down with a knee in the small of the perp's back as he bled into the carpet. As Gannon reholstered his pistol and tended to the woman bound to the chair, Robertson began to read the Miranda rights to Albright. The woman was Charlotte Ryder. She was a consultant for a phosphate mining and manufacturing company and had gone missing the same morning Timmins was found. Albright had been devolving and at a rapid pace. In a written statement, he backed up the claim that Severson was indeed the trigger that began his spree of violence. Online records show that he was active in several environmental terrorism forums and frequented the comments section of news stories reporting on ecological misdeeds. Albright's public defender was no match for the evidence stacked against his client, and a jury convicted him on 3 counts of murder and 1 count of attempted murder and kidnapping. During the sentencing phase of his trial, for which he was up for capital punishment, a prison officer found him in his cell, naked, save for his underwear, hanging by his neck, his prison jumpsuit fashioned into a rudimentary noose. He was removed, cremated, and his ashes were disposed of in an undisclosed location. You've been listening to The Arm Thief by A.W. Mason. A.W. Mason lives in Florida with his cats Wallace and Belle, retired extreme parkour artists who look so dapper in their little helmets and knee pads. He enjoys all the nachos, getting lost in the woods, and naps. Mason has published several books, including A Haunt of Travels, The Cleanup Crew, The Scampering, co-authored with Alana K. Drex, and Judy Martin's Final Curtain Call. His short stories have appeared in various anthologies. Well, listeners, I'm certainly rethinking any interest I might have had in that Neuralink thing I've been seeing in the news. I suppose I'm just a Luddite, slowing the forward progress of technology, but I'm pretty damn fond of having all my bits and bobs working as they should. Staving off vengeful amputation is just a nice bonus. Thanks to Sam Morris and A.W. Mason for tonight's stories, and thanks to all of you, listeners, for joining me. This isn't just lip service, either. You all have been incredibly generous with the fundraiser we have going, and that means a ton to me. As of this recording, we still have a bit to go on that, so please consider tossing a few bucks our way, if you can. I'll be returning next week at the same day and time to deliver more chilling tales for your macabre delight. Until then, my friends, stay spooky. You've been listening to the Horror Hill Podcast, a production of Chilling Entertainment and the creative team at Chilling Tales for Dark Nights. Tonight's episode was hosted and narrated by yours truly, Eric Peabody. Original music provided by Eric Peabody and Nikki McSorley.
Finalization by Eric Peabody and Craig Groshek. Got a terrifying tale of your own that you'd like performed? Email it to us at natalie@chillingtalesfordarknights.com to have your work considered for future production. Seeing as how we're all living in a technological nightmare of our own devising, I'll ask you to follow Chilling Tales for Dark Nights on social media and upvote, subscribe, and hit the bell notification icon if you're listening to this on YouTube. Not only will you have appeased the dark gods of cyberspace, but you'll be kept in the loop as we prepare more terrifying content. If you'd like access to uninterrupted horror, free of ads and these annoying bookend segments, might I recommend becoming a patron? You'll get access to hundreds of episodes of this show, as well as everything from the other programs in the Chilling Tales for Dark Nights cabal. That means all of Otis Gyre's Scary Stories Told in the Dark, Drew Blood's Dark Tales, Paul J. McSorley's Fear from the Heartland, and more. It's a veritable smorgasbord of horrific delights. As for me personally, I'm on most social media as Viking Guitar or Viking Guitar Productions. I'm always on the lookout for new stories to narrate and new music projects to mix or master. If that's of interest to you, feel free to reach out and we can talk turkey. Also, I will be back next week with more terrifying tales to keep you up all night. If darkness is what you're after, listener, your search is over. Yet, let it be known, you haven't found the darkness. The darkness has found you.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.